My wife just like nonchalantly threw this shade over my way. She went, "Just curious, how much money did we leave on the table when you sold NVIDIA?"
You it's went like, we like don't... a new house in the Bahamas.
Yeah, we don't talk about Bruno.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
Oh, how's your week? How are you? How you feeling?
Good, man. How about you?
Feeling like spring is really right around the corner. That's what I'm feeling like. Even though I got a little chills toward the end of the week, I'm feeling good about it.
You know how I'm actually feeling? I'm resenting the fact that you called the second top here. And who knows? I'm not calling the top. I don't make predictions. But when we dipped, when the stock market dipped and crypto died for a second and everyone pivoted from Web3 to AI, all the venture folks.
Oh, yeah.
Now we're back and there's like NFTs selling again. There's made up coins. Did you see the Joe Biden one? I don't know how you actually say it, but there's like a fake Joe Biden coin that made someone a millionaire this week.
I did not. No.
We are back in the craziness. Like the total, it's almost like we went bubbly times and it's almost the same bubble again. You got 0-day options on NVIDIA.
Oh, yes. I'm loving it. This is what I love. Don't resent me for this.
I can't believe you got it right. It's so irrational. And I thought since we had just been here, we weren't going back anytime soon.
People were not ready to acquiesce yet is the thing. People got to be ready to be done. And you know what's wild this year for me? This is wild for me. This is the way it should be, but it's wild for me. We are into March now. I still have not checked any of my portfolios for the year.
Oh, good for you.
That is buck That's wild great. For me. Because I'm all up in the dirty. I like to get up in the dirty and get dirty in the dirty. You know what I mean? And I haven't done it, but I'm excited. I'm excited to eventually do it. I think I'm going to wait till the quarter's done. So I get a whole quarter. I call it dry Q1. That's what I call it. I just made that up, but it works. And we'll
I like
see.
That. If anything, and I blame the podcast, if anything, I've been checking the portfolio balances more frequently. Mm-hmm. Bad idea, dude. Especially when this much craziness is happening out there.
Yeah,
super bad idea. Let's actually do some heavy hitting analysis here and talk about a great piece in the FT on private equity. Now, the crux of this is Norway's investment fund is thinking about investing in private equity. And the way that fund works, I'm going to like really simplify things here, is they have to ask their version of Congress, I think it's Parliament in Norway, for approval to change their investment approach. So generally, Norway takes money from oil and gas sales and invests a portion of it. They currently have a $1.6 trillion wealth fund, and they own the equivalent, where's the number, Dougals? It's like 1.5% of all the world's public equities, something
it's
like
wild.
That.
I like 1.6 trillion. Can we just, before you go on, let's just pause on that. $1.6 trillion. And we're talking about Norway. Like, this isn't off the radar for most people type portfolio from a size perspective. It's a country that is often not talked about. Like, when you bring up global economies and wealth and all that kind of stuff, like, Norway is not what pops up. That is wild. 1.6 trillion.
Well, here's the amazing thing. Their fund has effectively invested in Vanguard style. Like, they haven't paid crazy fees. They haven't done exotic investments. They haven't really done anything unique. They have just taken profits and effectively dollar cost average into public equities with amazing success. So Robin Wigglesworth from the Financial Times kind of breaks down and says, would this make sense for Norway's sovereign wealth fund to invest in private equity? They're saying they want to put 3-5% of their assets in private equity. The reason they're saying that is effectively because private equity has a decent track record. So he does, I mean, you called this what, a 30-page post? He does a really thorough breakdown here.
Yeah.
Loved it. Really good stuff. But the thing that jumped out to me is really his comparison between private equity returns and public stock market returns, which we've talked about on the show. Before I dive into that, though, I want to get your take. What do you think of the article? And is there anything I missed in the setup here?
Nothing you missed in the setup, because you hit on, I'll click one click deeper into one part, but you did hit on it. When you're talking about, let's call it 5%, and we discussed the 1.6 trillion, 5% of 1.6 trillion, $80 billion. Like, I just want folks to sit on the amount of money that we're talking about putting to private equity. So that's huge. Otherwise, you hit on it. What's tough for me is this is all confirmation bias type. It's a great article. Confirmation bias for me, because I have for probably about 20 years been hating on private equity. Not all forms. Private equity is such a big umbrella. So I'm not talking about all the things that fall into private equity that are like venture capital as an example. But I mean, when we're talking about the private equity firms, it's just, this is just reinforcing my prior beliefs. But in a more balanced and contextual way, I'd say than typical. I mentioned the book I read recently, These Are the Plunderers, which is just a beat down. Like, this book probably should have been about 120 pages and it was about 400 pages because it just goes, here's another example. Here's another example, right? Those hit the same points. But I love this. Great setup.
I probably have a natural bias against private equity as well. One of the reasons I feel like it's important to talk about is just because it's apples to oranges, but it's worse than that. And people try and act like it's apples to apples all the time. And it's just garbage. Now, my caveat with my prior bias, which I think is important to do, is there are some really good, I mean, some of the small business acquisition and some of that space is private equity like, and it's just smart people that are willing to work super hard to better their future. Like, so you can't paint a broad stroke on all private equity.
Yeah,
here's the thing that I think is amazingly well done in the article, and I just want to touch on 4 points. So Robin says, this wouldn't be super smart for Norway to do because the historical returns for private equity are skewed. And here's why. There's four reasons. First is private equity is about 80% based in the US, and the US stock market has outperformed the world stock market recently. So private equity's returns are tilted to the outperforming stock market. When that corrects, it's going to go the other way. Second, private equity often gets compared to like the S&P 500. Well, it's not the S&P 500 like stocks. They're much smaller companies. So if you compare private equity to small caps, you get closer. If you compare it to small caps that are largely based in the US, you get closer. Then often in private equity, averages and annualized returns are talked about. Well, some of the off the charts returns come from the lowest funds. This happens in mutual funds and ETFs as well. So when you take an average, it skews things towards the guy that bought, you know, three mom and pop shops and did 40% a year. When if you're putting $80 billion to play, like you talked about, you don't even have access to those returns. So that's misleading. And finally, and most importantly, public equity markets are unlevered, thought of without debt. And private equity funds and leveraged buyout funds almost always include debt. So if you're in a situation where you have high performing recency bias, I'll call it, like because you are tilted towards small caps in the US, which have performed fairly well, and you put leverage on top of that, of course your returns look greater. So it's just different stratospheres of annual returns that get lumped together. And the folks in Norway, but the folks at, you know, all the big endowments in the US have made similar cases over the years, try and say, this is a better risk adjusted return. And I would just push back on that. That doesn't mean there's no place for it in your large portfolio, but it's not for me.
Those are all great and objective. I'll come with a subjective thing too. There isn't, for what we're talking about, the big firms that we're talking about, there's also generally not value creation as the core mechanism for creating returns. It's dementor level vampire, I'm a suck your blood type-ish, and capitalism at its rawest form. And I'm saying this actually not even to be, I'm not trying to be overtly negative toward the firms. I think this is what they do. What they see is, I see dollars that are there, invest with me. I'm going to take out everything unnecessary and give you dollars back. And they can do that. But it's straight up, if you know the Harry Potters, it's straight up Dementor up in chill.
The show is better when there's some passion. So bring it, Diggles. Thank you for this. You're going to make me go. All right. So what has private equity done recently in the last decade or two? They have rolled up plumbing firms and HVAC firms and everything else. And I had work done on my house this week where I know that I ended up hiring a private equity backed firm that's branded as a local firm, right? When I initially signed the contract, I was like 70% sure. And then when the work, in the process of the work being completed, I was 100% sure that the service operations are happening in house. You call the people, and it's not like Margaret in the office that you talk to every time. It's like some random person who knows where. And you talk to a different person every time at the dispatch center. And it's crazy, right? For this fairly simple piece of work, by my count, this company has already had 14 vehicle trips to my house. How are they making any money, Douglas? Like, it's so outsourced and insane. Crazy experience.
The worst is when they get up in healthcare.
Oh, yep.
Oh, I mean, I can't start because I won't stop. Like, this will be
already in dentistry like crazy,
which is healthcare.
Yeah.
And when you start to say there are healthcare organizations that are for profit, and you can run for profit organizations that are not just value destructive. So it's not just that component, but it's when you combine the leverage that you discuss, because for people that don't know, when we talk about leverage buyouts, the debt that is taken out gets put on the company. And so imagine an organization that is meant to take care of your parents, your aging parents, mm-hmm. in their home of nursing. And it is now saddled with lots of debt and fees that it has to pay back. And so therefore, what do you sacrifice in order to get that money? You sacrifice the care.
You sacrifice everything because you have this debt burden that goes for years and years. Thank you for bringing this up. I didn't think the show was going here. You take the optionality out of the manager of that business because they have this heavy debt burden that they have to find a way to generate revenue for in the future. If it's truly a mom and pop shop, you have the ability to do, it's not even favors. It's sometimes do the right thing, irregardless of the financial consequences of that, because you're unlevered, because you don't have a heavy debt burden. So anytime private equity gets involved, sorry, that's a broad generalization, but often when private equity gets involved, you handcuff the employer and a lot of things suffer because of it.
And we were talking about Norway here, getting up in this, but the other organizations that are turning to alternative investments, which private equity can fit into that, are also pension funds, teacher pensions. I think it's problematic. It's understandable. So it's understandable because when you have $1.6 trillion per what you were talking about earlier, you got to figure out how to make returns on that money. That's like a hard pool of money to be able to disperse. And so you look at public stock market investing, you look at bonds, you look at, you know, and then you go, oh, we still got $1 trillion laying around, whatever, you know, I'm making that, obviously it's not that big. We still got a whole bunch of money laying around. Where do you put it? And with companies, as this article talks about, with companies staying private longer, that means that a lot of the returns are potentially sitting in private companies. So what do you do as an organization that's trying to deploy that capital? So I understand the exploration. However, we got teachers' pensions that are sitting up in some of these organizations that are investing in FTX. FTX, remember them? Yeah. Don't act like you forgot.
I read a whole book about it. It was great. Loved every second of the book.
That's true.
So
that's true.
I mean, all right. Ooh. Step down off the soapbox. What's in your fishbowl, Douglas?
All right. I'm gonna reach in the fishbowl. Here's something I'm gonna talk about. You inspired me to do this because you were talking about within private equity the over-indexing in the U.S. I found this to be quite interesting. UBS, UBS, as it's commonly known in the banking world.
Not at all. No one has ever said that.
UBS, there's this global investment returns yearbook. We got the 25th anniversary coming out here. Very exciting. But there's one chart I want to bring up here that knocked my socks off. I got bare toes right now. You can't see it. I got bare toes right now because it's knocked my socks off. That was looking at the comparison between 1899 and the Deuce Zero, Deuce Four. Mm-hmm. And what the global stock market. Year. Yeah. I'm opening my eyes here. What the global stock market breakdown was from a country perspective, like percent of market capitalization breakdown across different countries. So in the US, we're talking about 61% when they created this. 61% of global market cap sat in the United States of America in 2024. Rewind that back to 1899, the US, about 15%. And it was what was the wildest for me is not just the US, but how generally evenly distributed. And I don't know what record keeping really looked like back in 1899. I'll just say that. But relative today, there wasn't a monster. Like the monster, if you had to choose one back then, was the UK, the kingdom that is united. And UK was 24.2% is what this is showing back in 1899. That was the biggest. Then you got the US at about 15, Germany at 13, France at 11. You fast forward that to 2024, US is 61. The next is Japan at 6%. The next is Japan. Japan! We talked about Japan so much here. An organization, like a place that has not created a return in 30 years.
It's out of whack. The funny thing, not funny, but if you look at these estimates going back like thousands of years, you see dominance like the US has now with China and other like so-called global dynasties in terms of wealth creation.
Did you say thousands of years?
Yeah,
you're talking about the S&P 500 in the year 6 AD?
Hold on. I said estimates of global wealth going back thousands of years. I'm not claiming they're perfect, but to me, it's funny, right? Say our lifespan's 100 years. So sometimes it's value add to look back thousands of years, even though that time frame just seems crazy. No, this chart's nuts. It has been nuts for the past 15 years, maybe.
What also caught me was maybe this is politically correct, or at least trying to be politically correct perspective, is in 2024, Taiwan is listed. Okay, Taiwan's listed. When I see Taiwan listed, I go, ooh, how does China feel about that? Because China's claim is Taiwan is part of China. It's not a separate country. So why are you listing it separately? China is labeled as mainland China. I said, oh, okay, that's how they must have tried to balance a little something, something there. So I was curious about that one. But this, it caught me off guard. And if you go back to when Japan was, you know, king of the world when it came to market capitalization, I think it was in the 40 to 50% range, something like that, right? I don't remember exactly, but it's kind of wild that came down to 6%. So these things change is the point.
Yeah, it's right here on page 12. In 1990, yeah, it's tough to eyeball it, but Japan was, 40, call it 30-ish percent of world market cap. Crazy, crazy stats.
Crazy. It's crazy, crazy.
All right, I know you're a betting man.
Yes, I am.
If I told you that you could buy, I'll start with a long list of companies. What if I told you Diageo, UPS, Philip Morris International, Nike, Shell Oil, McDonald's, L'Oreal, Nestle, Costco, and LVMH, I'm going to give you all those, or I can give you one company called NVIDIA. What you taking?
Which side am I going to go on?
Yeah.
NVIDIA.
No, you're not.
Can I buy it without the N? Just go straight NVIDIA?
The jokes on this show go back so many years. I feel really bad for new listeners really all the time. I know. Okay, those companies I just named, the reason I named them is because they have the same market cap as NVIDIA right now. But those are like the companies you hear talked about when people talk about moats, right? Like, this Costco is so defensible. Like, Nike, you know, like Diageo, get some Guinness up in here. Like those are companies that are revered. You can have all of them for the same price as NVIDIA.
That's such a bet on the future that it can't be right.
Can't be right long term, but it could be right for another 6 months, 2 years, who knows?
That is true, but like can't be right long term. It just can't. I don't know what else to say.
I know life doesn't work this way, and I feel like some of those companies I named, like McDonald's, is in my eyes overvalued right now. Costco might be on the high side of its true value. But honestly, if I was in, you know, my brokerage app thinking about buying Nvidia, and this is not a problem for me, like I don't have this problem, but and there was a button that said buy these other 11 high quality companies instead, that'd be really convincing for me. I'd be like, that is, yeah, I'm taking that.
That's an interesting feature. That's like a really interesting feature. You could do that, or you could do this other thing. That's a fascinating feature. So, and for those that are newer listeners, I'm just going to put a little disclaimer in here. I'm not a Nvidia hater. I love Nvidia. I love this organization. Jensen, I think, is one of the boldest, if nothing else, boldest CEOs we've had in quite a while. Love it. Owned this organization for a while. Gave me a nice sizable return. In fact, the other day, my wife just like nonchalantly threw this shade over my way. She went, just curious, how much money did we leave on the table when you sold Nvidia?
You it's went like a new house in the Bahamas.
Yeah, we don't talk about Bruno. Okay. Yeah. We don't talk about Bruno. So I am not an Nvidia hater. Love it. And I'm still gonna say this current story cannot be right. I mean, you're not gonna disagree with that. You're even stronger in that camp than I am.
Yeah.
So yep. But I also don't know.
I told you it was
companies.
Insane at $400 a share. I think it's 900 now. Let me drill in on this point. I think we're going the same direction here. So market cap's the same. I'm going to list these companies again. Diageo, UPS, Philip Morris International, Nike, Shell Oil, McDonald's, L'Oreal, Nestle, Costco, and LVMH. The combined revenue of those companies is $1 trillion. The revenue of Nvidia, $61 billion. That's okay. Different.
Apples, apples.
The estimated operating margin, they call it EBIT here, of those companies is like $150 billion. Nvidia, $33 billion. By every metric, I'd rather have those other companies. Every metric.
Wow. But the story, tell me about the metric of the story. Can you compare those?
You want to talk stories here? I got Nike and McDonald's and Diageo over here. I got the world's best collection of luxury brands with LVMH. I got Costco, the huge Munger play. Nestle is like, have you seen Nestle's portfolio of food brands? Like, you can't do anything in the developed world without eating Nestle products every day. It's impossible.
This is the worst story I've ever heard.
Let's hear your story on Nvidia.
Are you kidding me right now? First of all, your spokesperson's Allen Iverson. Second of all, AI. It's a little AI joke. Second of all, when you look at the future of the globe, let's go forward 10 years. The only thing that we all know is certain is that the entire workforce is going to shift from where we are today into a place where the jobs that we know today are not going to be done by humans. They will be done through AI. Humans will be evolved to a place where we can now be more productive. We can do more with less. And it's only possible because of Jensen in an apron.
When my daily routine involves me eating some silicon wafers, me wearing silicon on my feet, me drinking some silicon, and the people that like nicotine, this is a Philip Morris joke, like putting silicon in their lip, we can talk.
AI will do all that. Yeah. I get it. It's really fascinating. I think that the types of comparisons that you're making there are very helpful for people to get away from the big bold story that is just on faith and understand what you're really doing at that moment. Like, what are you telling yourself? What has to be true? What do you need to believe? I think it's a really helpful comparison.
It's it's that providing context. Like, data storytelling is all about providing context, and it's good.
All right.
Can I fish jump bowl? Into your fishbowl? Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna reach into the fishbowl. This is not shade for the sake of shade. I got a maid in the shade, so don't worry about that. But it's not shade for the sake of shade. This is me reaching in the fishbowl to just throw out some confusion and questions on, and actually being impressed with a fund that has managed to lose a lot of money, but retain a lot of money in investment. This fund I'm talking about, this fund that I'm discussing here, is the Hussmann Strategic Growth Fund. We've discussed Hussmann on here before. Smart dude, and his take on the market being overvalued, right? Which there are other takes around that, but very smart, logical, scientific breakdown on what future returns could look like. And this is a money meet mouth moment, is what I'll say, because you put your money where your mouth is, right? This fund is effectively betting against the stock market doing well, and it's been doing it for 24 years. Now, that's oversimplification, but
yeah, you're oversimplifying it. But larger point is, he's been very concerned about valuations for a long time. And I'm just going to say, I think his analysis is awesome. I read a lot of his stuff, but it's kind of one of those, the larger story might be, it's really tough sledding being a perma bear, because this is what I talk about when people decide they want to short a stock or whatever. You still have thousands of people at that company show up every day and be like, my livelihood depends on this, and I'm going to figure out a way to make it work. So stocks go up more than they go down. That's just how this works.
And especially over this last 10 to 15 years. So if you take a look at this fund for the last 10 years, the return before taxes, the annual return before taxes over the last 10 years was negative 3.29% per year. Think about the last decade. For the S&P 500, the average annual return, 12.56%. That is about 15% annual premium you're getting from the S&P 500. That is aggressively bad. Between 2013 and 2017, it lost money every year. That's a hard time to lose money in the U.S. stock market on a consistent basis.
Yep.
In 2018, it made money because the stock market was down. In 2022, it was up 17%. That's awesome, right? Like, that's great. But this is so difficult to do. And what the prospectus that I was looking at, it was in the latter half of 2023 is when this was released. And so it was showing that as of September 30th, it was down 7% last year. Mm-hmm. This is rough. But the impressive part to me, the impressive component, is that there's still hundreds of millions of dollars that folks have invested in this fund, and it's been around for 24 years. That is thoroughly impressive. Like, what is the story that you can continue to tell to get folks to keep their money in here? That's an impressive piece of work.
I wish I knew. So part of what's going on here is it's a long short fund. You have the perfect perspectives in front of me. I don't, but very likely he's taking long bets on the stuff that has value and shorting the stuff that's like high growth, insane valuations. It's been the worst time in the world to do that, because So he loses money on all sides, basically, as growth runs away from value.
But strategically, he loses that money strategically.
And then the expense ratio on this thing is 1.2%. Whew.
Yeah.
Now, there is a trailing 12-month yield of about 3%. So there's like, call it a dividend play, but whew, the data I saw is that of over 10,000 funds tracked in the universe, the 20-year record for the current worst performing fund of those is the Hussmann Strategic Growth Fund. That's amazing.
Yes,
well,
it's amazing.
No, it's amazing that there's still $350 million in assets in this thing.
It's impressive. It is thoroughly impressive to me. To be able to continue
storytelling, right? Exactly. I mean, I think he does a good job explaining his rationale, and so maybe that makes the money sticky.
I'm curious about turnover. I didn't look at that. Like, what is turnover of the fund? Well, I guess maybe you can't even look this up because what they show is turnover of the portfolio, but I don't think you can generally see turnover of the investors.
You probably could, but I don't have it handy. Yeah. Anyway, fascinating story, and not throwing shade. Like his analysis.
Yeah.
Happy that I haven't invested in that fund. Let's put it that way.
I like your analysis, and please and no thank you. All right, what you got next?
We've talked about this a little bit. So University of Colorado came out with a study this week, and I'm having computer issues, that basically studied the reason why people don't hold blatant lies against politicians that they like. So the example here is if President Biden up on the State of the Union address says something, I don't know that he said anything that was blatantly false, but just for this example, says something that's false. You go, yeah, it's a half truth. He had to do it. He's playing politics, whatever. If former President Trump says something, in this case, it's easier to use the blatant lie context. But really, this relates to all politicians. It's not about those two individuals. The people that support them go, it makes sense. He's, you know, like, he's sure he's playing with the facts a little, but I still understand why they do that. Basically, they found without fail that your average voter, and it was a large majority, it was like 80% of voters, would not hold a blatant lie against someone that they believe in or support, and would hold it against someone they don't. So this is why we can't have a fact-based conversation about anything. The facts don't matter. The lies don't matter.
Is this an end justifies the means type
thing? That's the, you know, I use this phrase a lot. You hate it when I do. That's the story that we tell ourselves is, oh, well, yes, but what Trump supports would be so much better for the economy that the end justify the means, or what Biden supports was right. Here's how crazy this is right now. And this is an investing podcast. 26% of people. Here's a question. This is from a survey of recent voters. Thinking about the nation's economy, how would you rate economic conditions today? 26% of people said good or excellent, and 74% of people said only fair to poor. 51%, the majority of people surveyed, said economic conditions today are poor. Here's some economic conditions from the last week. Unemployment, 3.7%. Annualized GDP, 3.2%. Real wage growth, 1.8%. Annualized CPI, 3.1%. Last year's S&P 500 return, 27%. You could make an argument. We could have a nuanced discussion that maybe the economy is not the best ever, but like, it's in the stratosphere of like, what, a top 20 percentile economy? For, I mean, it is unobjectively not a bad economy right now.
But there are two different things I'm hearing here, though. So there's one, the first point you were bringing up is if someone tells a blatant lie and you know that they are lying, you will excuse it if you believe in that politician.
Yes.
The second part is not believing facts. And those are two different things. You believing the lie and you, no?
You're right. But I think they're related here. Maybe I've jumped to a conclusion that's not fair. I think the majority of people that rated this poor would likely be in a camp that doesn't like the current administration.
So it's independent of the facts. It's just independent of facts.
So yeah, this is like, it's not a lie because it's facts we're talking about, but it is like discarding something that.
Yeah. So if I do not believe in Biden, don't like Biden, so long as Biden is president, the economy can't be good.
Yes, it can't be. Because
we just have to be better than this. We just have to be better than this.
Well, and to say the reverse, if we had the same economic conditions today and Trump was president, there would be a large majority of people, well, there would be a huge camp of people that would say the economy can't be good right now. What I want is just for people to look at the economic conditions and make a fair judgment. Now, the other argument that always happens here is, yeah, but my grocery bill, like how I feel about the economy is not a fact-based thing. That's true.
That's true. That's
totally true.
That's true.
But man, it's... Yeah.
Have you seen a study that someone's done where you pull out years from data and just have data and ask people their opinion on the economy, but just based on that, do it over like a 50-year period. And you can even randomize, like don't put it in order and just go like rate the economy just based on these factors. And then pull the data out now and just show who's president and ask the same people about the economy, then put the two pieces together.
That's get a reaction. Point. I already know the answer. When they looked at the randomized data without year and without whoever's president, they'd be more objective. And then when you said so-and-so is president, they'd say, oh, actually, that's fool's gold. The economy is not good. I remember that time back in 73. Oh, my goodness. I know the numbers look good, but that's not how it felt.
This is so related to the conversation we were having earlier when you were comparing all those stocks to NVIDIA. It's very similar because if you just look at the data, right, that you were showing, the comparison of data, and then say, where would you think would be the most intelligent place to put your money? Or you say, you want to invest in some burgers and some makeup? I'm talking about AI, right? It's different, but in the same vein,
yeah,
of psychology.
Wow. I totally agree.
Powerful, powerful. You got anything else in the bowl?
No.
I'm clean.
All right. That's a wrap, guys. Reminder, the show is headed to Omaha on May 4th. For the shindig out there with Berkshire Hathaway. Dougals is probably going to make us wear stupid shirts, so that's how you'll find us. I'm super excited about that, as you guys can tell. We offer premium subscriptions, which help support the behind-the-scenes cost of the show and give you benefits like getting the show early, some premium drops with how we're thinking about our portfolio and other things. You can find those at skippydougals.supercast.com. All things related to the show, skippydougals.com. And listener mail, skippydougals@gmail.com.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
See ya.